Just for a moment, forget the here and now. Leap forward with me some 45 years into the future. Listen to the news.
Mr. President, look over here, please.
Mr. Prime Minister.
President,
yes, thank you, Peter. Well, the Russians have had better luck with the weather for the 2050 summit of the G7 than the Chinese did last year. The sun is blazing down on the Kremlin.
Mr. President, this way, please.
You join us just as the leaders of the world's seven richest countries are lining up for the traditional photo call. It's a...
Oh, my God.
Well, this is rather extraordinary. The President of the United States has just elbowed her way past her Brazilian, Russian and Japanese counterparts to rather rudely squeeze in at the centre of the row between the leaders of China and India. It's a bizarre sight. All I can think of is that the Americans are still having a hard time accepting that they're no longer the centre of the world.
The news in 2050, as it just might be, a huge upheaval in the global landscape, new players in the great game of nations, new countries at the top table of the world. That's the powerful thesis from an influential source, the giant American investment bank Goldman Sachs. I'm Peter Day, and over the next 4 weeks I'll be looking at the BRICS, the thesis that Brazil, Russia, India and China, BRICS, you see, will be global economic powerhouses by 2050. If it's right, then our world is about to change dramatically. Let's start here in Fleet Street, once a mighty newspaper centre, now home to the London offices of Goldman Sachs, the base for the man behind the BRICS thesis, their global economist, Jim O'Neill. Let's begin at the beginning. How is the world going to change in the next 50 years?
I think it's potentially going to change dramatically. If other countries allow globalization to help them and the demographics work as the way they seem to, as though they're going to work, before 2050, there will only be two of the current G7 that are part of the G7 in terms of size. That would be the US and Japan.
Okay, I know this is radio, but let's look at this. We have a map of the world here, and now in sort of economic terms, North America is absolutely enormous. Japan is pretty big, if this is done in relative size of economies rather than size of geographies. And then Europe is also pretty big. Those are the main players, the main top table players at the moment.
Yep.
The rest are tiny by comparison, aren't they?
Well, China has just, in the past couple of years, as people probably know, overtaken Italy and is currently sitting just behind France and the UK. But, you know, that is nothing compared with what we're about to see unfold over the next 20 plus years. If we're right, there are enormous opportunities in consumer goods industries, particularly in China and India, but also in Russia and Brazil. And many global consumer goods industries will be transformed by this process.
And here I am investigating those consumer goods industries Jim O'Neill just talked about. I'm in Brazil's business capital, Sao Paulo, and I'm in Dazlu. It's one of the most extravagant department stores I've ever seen anywhere, with elegant personal shopping assistants standing by to escort high-spending clients into a discreet world of luxury. China's hunger for raw materials has injected huge sums of money into Brazil in recent years, and some of it's clearly being spent here, just a few hundred yards from one of Sao Paulo's infamous favelas, or slums. I'm here for a tour of what Priscilla Castelo Branco of Dazlu insists is more than just a shopping center.
It's not a mall, it's not.
What is it then?
Just like magical. It's magical.
Okay, magic away then.
So let's go. This first floor, men are not allowed, only women. Because we don't have, how do you say, for you to change.
Changing room.
Changing room. We don't have that. It's everything open, like in your house, women, everyone changing and picking up clothes. And then if men wants to come and buy something for their wives or for their friend or something, we have our sellers who come and they help you.
Yeah, well, that's the way the world is going. Concierges,
is it?
If I come in and suddenly want an embarrassingly flimsy piece of lingerie for somebody I know.
She comes and she will show you all our models and then you choose which one you want.
Perfect.
Chanel, right in front of us. Louis Vuitton, And Giuhenieri, that's our flower store.
Oh, and the Greek gods, or the Roman gods. Are they? No, what are they? Greek or Roman?
I don't know, actually. We can
But they're wreathed. They're wreathed. So they're, except for the ones with pots on their heads, they're wreathed.
It's only decoration.
Are there other places like this in Brazil?
No.
Why has it happened here in Sao Paulo, then?
Why has it happened?
Because I'm looking long, taking a long view, a long-term view, looking right out into the 21st century, when some economists think Brazil, Russia, India and China are going to be right up at the top of the most economically powerful nations. Mm-hmm. And this is a little bit of a preview, isn't it?
I hope so. But Brazil is a very poor country.
Yes, exactly. That's why it's so bizarre to have this in Brazil.
It's a very poor country, but we do have few people with economic power.
And they come here.
They do.
As a barista dispenses strong and complimentary coffee to the store's visitors, I'm joined by a chic woman who runs Dazlu's glossy magazine. Patricia Ramalho has her own insights into Brazil's changing fortunes.
If you come to Brazil, you realize there are two Brazils. I wouldn't say only about rich Brazil and poor Brazil, but I would tell you serious Brazil, private Brazil, and public Brazil. 10 years ago, you couldn't have a telephone. You had to wait like 3 years to get a line, and then suddenly they privatized, and now, you know, it's a market. You can have a telephone, prices are going down.
But this gap between the rich and the poor, which is so extreme here.
Yes, it's very extreme. This is why you have a thousand.
Which is why you have this house here, but very close you have a favela.
And people intend to blame Dazlu. No, we would love to have tons of Dazlus and no favelas. This would be the good thing. It's not Dazlu's fault that you have the favelas. It's not the case at all.
But for 100 years, people have been talking about Brazil as the next great economic nation. For 100 years, this has happened. This ought to be a very exciting time, a very exciting prospect for Brazil. But does that doubt hold Brazil back? The fact that it hasn't happened for 100 years make it seem unlikely to happen in the future?
It does, but my generation, for example, we didn't see the Brazilian boom happen, so we don't know if we believe in the Brazilian boom or not. So this is why we do it privately. If you want to take Dazlu as an example, you know, all the employees, they have schools, they have kindergartens for the kids. So sometimes we think about Brazil as each big company gives the good example. Then we can maybe build a better Brazil, because if we don't get it from the government, let's try us to do it.
But there's a lot to be done.
Oh my God, a lot of be done. We don't invest in good infrastructure, and I think the worst thing of this country is that they don't invest enough in education. If they don't invest on education, you'll never be like the Chinese or the Koreans. This is why they go so fast, because they invest on education.
This is an extraordinary conversation to be having in one of the most luxurious shops I've ever been in the world.
But this is the way us wealthy Brazilian, if you want to take it this way, because I can't reach, you know, northeast of Brazil. So if I do good stuff in my community, maybe lots of small communities going up, maybe we can help Brazil to come up as a whole.
That's what the economists in Wall Street think is going to happen. We'll just have to come back in 50 years' time and see.
Okay.
Patricia Ramalho suggests private business in Brazil distrusts the government. And the feeling appears to be mutual. Shortly after our conversation, Brazilian tax authorities raided Dazlu's offices. The world can be a more complicated place than economists' equations may imply. The fact is that all four BRICS countries have a vast chasm to bridge. There are 2.7 billion people, roughly half the world's population. Yet wealth levels in Brazil and Russia are barely 10% of countries such as the United States and Japan. China and India are even poorer. Is it really possible for these developing countries to pull their people into the club of the wealthiest nations by 2050?
Actually, I think if there is one thing I disagree with, is the 50-year time frame.
The Indian-born American management guru, Professor C.K. Prahalad, the author of The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, does he think these countries can really create the consumer goods bonanza which Jim O'Neill is predicting.
The growth engines are starting from ground up. It is internal consumption, people getting rich. They want more of everything, from shampoos to washing machines to televisions to cell phones. I do not believe it's going to take 40 years before these economies will have a place in the sun.
And that means something for the rest of us. This is a whole new global economic landscape, a new map of the world, isn't it?
Yeah. I think the last time that China and India dominated world trade was in 1780s. So it's not clear to me that in the year 2030, India and China will not have a disproportionate amount of world trade, and certainly a disproportionate size of local market. And that is all built on the basis of people who are now considered to be poor.
With your Indian and American perspective, of course, you've got a very interesting view on this. It's not going to be easy for the established top players, Europe and particularly America, to move over, maybe down, but certainly sideways in this new global economy, is it?
To believe that the most innovative application of technology can take place among people who are very poor is something we have to come to terms with.
Then how can Western companies survive? How can they reinvent themselves in this new globally competitive marketplace?
I always say, build it for the poor, the rich will come.
But can you build it for the poor in the established Western countries? Don't you have to export your manufacturing and then your service centers and then your brain power work to the poor countries with low wage costs simply to have any profit margin at all in this new 6 billion consumer world?
The answer is yes. The only place where you will have to totally break your mental models is by going to these markets. And that is why it is exciting.
But that's not very exciting for the people who are pushed out of jobs in manufacturing, in service industries, in call centers in the West. That's a brutal message underlying your rather benign view of this rich, enriching world.
A $30 DVD player is what we like as consumers. But as managers and employees, we don't like the consequences of wanting a $30 player.
The Indian-born American management guru and academic C.K. Prahalad. All change for the rich countries, their companies, their workers. This is BRICS, the changing face of world power, from the BBC World Service. I'm Peter Day. Back at Goldman Sachs, I pulled out my map for The Economist Jim O'Neill.
Let's have another look at our map. Here we are, 2050. And oh yes, it's quite a different shape, isn't it, from the familiar one we have in our heads. Great big America, fairly big Europe, great big Japan. We're talking relativities, of course. Those countries aren't going to shrink. They're going to shrink in economic terms relative to the BRICS newcomers, you argue. So what, China is absolutely enormous on this map now?
On this map, if we put China physically on it, we wouldn't be able to keep the map up. It would be so heavy.
India close behind it because it's got a similar population or a bigger one by then.
Put the two together, then, you know, the world might tip up on its, this map would tip up on its side and would be sort of sloping down in an Asian direction. And of course, if Russia can do something to control its population dynamics better and allow parts of eastern Russia to grow well, enormous shift of gravity on a map like this to this massive great blob in the middle of the east, because, you know, Russia, of course, borders on with China and India, so you can have enormous shift in the world's relative balance. Absolutely enormous.
A new economic landscape.
Very much. A completely different economic landscape than we have today, which brings with it enormous issues about security and politics and the relationship between security councils and global economic and political policy making.
In fact, a clue to the changes in global economic and political policy making, which Jim O'Neill talks about, may be found in this unlikely venue, a concert by a choir of underprivileged teenagers in Sao Paulo. They're serenading a superstar of Brazilian music, Gilberto Gil, a cabinet minister in the troubled government of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. There's a new mood in Brazil, says Gilberto Gil.
I mean, to have a lot of hope today. But at the same time, we balance. We feel that it's not necessarily repeating US or repeating Europe, you know. We've been able to discover our own particularities, you know.
And what qualities would Brazil bring to the top table if it ever were to get there?
Softness. We have never been in a war against a foreign enemy. Never. We don't want conquering or invading, taking from other countries. Brazil is building up a new cycle of civilization.
Gilberto Gil, the Brazilian singer and politician. Gilberto Gil may have his soft vision of diplomacy, but geopolitics brings some hard realities. And already Brazil is speaking with a stronger voice at such global trade forums as the World Trade Organization. In fact, the country's become a standard bearer for much of the developing world. Pedro de Camargo Neto was Brazil's trade negotiator at the beginning of the decade.
We Brazilians did a lot of things wrong, but in the past 10, 15 years, we corrected a number of things and our potential now is appearing.
There is a new trading map to the world, isn't there? This is transforming the whole way the world trades.
Of course. Now Brazil is not only the exporter leader, but we are also a political leader. We are now sitting at the table by ourselves. We talk. We don't have to be behind Australia. I have nothing against Australia. I like them very much. But it's a different part of the world, a different size of population, and we can speak by ourselves.
That the political world is very slow to reflect these trade changes, these export changes, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the United Nations. The world is going to change. The institutions that run the world or try to run the world must change too.
Of course, because you cannot have what you had up to very recently, that the developed world institutions imposed what they wanted to the rest. This does not work anymore. You have to negotiate. We have something to say. We have to fit ourselves. We're not going to impose anything. We don't want anything imposed.
It was kind of simple before. It was rich world and poor world, wasn't it? Producers and consumers, that sort of world. It's getting complicated, isn't it?
Oh, it was like this. Sign here. This is good for you. I know. And now we read it, and I think we don't think so. We think it should be written a little differently.
And your voice can be heard.
Heard, and I have received an immense support in the developed world. The developed world citizens want this. It is not a war with the developed world. It's a transformation.
In one of Washington, D.C.'s swankiest lobbies, the drink is flowing at this reception at the World Bank, whose job it is to help the poor. The institution may be castigated by anti-globalization campaigners, but it's also home to some of the world's most committed development economists. How does their thinking about the future chime with the BRICS thesis? First, Gobind Nankani, World Bank Regional Vice President for Africa.
Well, I think one thing that is becoming very clear is that the world in 2050 is certainly going to be a lot more multipolar, by which I mean there'll be more centers of power. I think the reference to the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, is just one manifestation of emerging centers of power.
Another World Bank Vice President, Danny Leipziger, predicts it will be a tri-polar world.
We'll have the rich countries as we know them now, a new group that is currently growing very rapidly, which includes China, but in addition, other emerging giants, as they may be known. A lot of talk now about India, potentially Brazil, if they get their policies straight, and a few other countries, so that may well be a second category of country. And then what worries us at the World Bank is that the third group, which will have the majority of the world's poor, will still be at the bottom of the barrel.
Worries about the poor, but hints that the rich should be worried too.
I don't think people have woken up to how the development of the developing world would affect the industrialized world.
The Brazilian economist Roberto Zaga, an advisor to the World Bank's Poverty Reduction Network.
The challenge for policymakers will be that nations will continue to exist as nations, but there will be a blurring of being developed and developing, and there will be much more contrast, diffuse contrast in the same country. Like today, you don't see the working poor in America. but they're around you. They are in the gas station and they have three jobs and the kids don't have a hope of going to college. You go to Hyderabad today and it's not very far from a well-developed city in Italy. So I think the change is as much in developing countries as in industrialized countries.
Prognostications from some World Bank economists. It all sounds to me a lot more complicated than what we had moving out of the 20th century, a single superpower, America. Clyde Prestowitz was an American trade representative for the Reagan administration 20 years ago. He's the author of a provocative recent book, 3 Billion New Capitalists, and he says globalization, that combination of falling trade barriers and opening economies, the world becoming a single marketplace, globalization has entered a decisive new phase.
We've been talking globalization, we're using that word for a long time, but it really has been Americanization. And now globalization is going global, truly going global, with the rise of the BRICS and the shift in the distribution of global power.
In other words, says Clyde Prestowitz, for the BRICS, economic power will inevitably translate into social and cultural and political power as well.
There's not going to be any more G8. It's going to be G9 or G10 or G11, I don't know what. But China's going to come into that. India's coming into that. Brazil is coming into that.
The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund?
Sure. The World Bank, International Monetary Fund, all of the voting weights and all these are going to change. And the BRICS, China, Brazil, India, Russia, are going to have more weight. Doesn't mean they're going to be exclusive. Doesn't mean that they're going to dictate things. But we're not going to dictate things. That's going to be the big change. We're not going to dictate things.
That's a very big change for you Americans, isn't it?
It's a huge change. And most Americans haven't realized that this is coming.
Just as the end of communism changed the shape of a world we'd been familiar with, so the likely, maybe inevitable rise of the BRICS nations will redraw the map of global power. Like a train, I can hear it coming. But when and how? Next week, I'll be at an advertising shoot in India, looking for signs that this new world is already taking shape and looking at how it's reshaping BRICS societies.